Our subject now is the Book of Proverbs. And I'd like to begin by reading the first four verses of the book. The Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, to know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, and judgment and equity, to give subtlety to the simple, to the young man, knowledge and direction. The Book of Proverbs is a window on life. It's a book which is particularly aimed at young people, young people today. In the time of a new morality, it is for the rising generation. Young people today are experimental objects, thrown to the wolves by society, taught nothing of moral values. It's a vicious and it's an indifferent society. It's a society overthrowing all biblical and historical moral standards, and with complete indifference to what the outcome may be for the happiness of the young. The Book of Proverbs gives us a remarkable contrast. Verse 8 of chapter 1, My son, it is one of the most sympathetic books in the Bible. My son, hear the instruction of thy father and forsake not the law of thy mother. The father figure has authority. He dispenses the standards, the discipline, the decisions. The mother, the care, the love, the sympathy, the kindness, the comfort. And so both are here. My son, hear the instruction of thy father and forsake not the law of thy mother. It's a storehouse of wisdom, insights into human nature and society just pour forth. But there are four major points I'd like to mention to be borne in mind as we approach the Book of Proverbs. First of all, and I think these four are extremely important. First of all, it is a book of parables. That really must be appreciated. That's what the word Proverbs really means. Parables. Comparisons. Some say that there is even the element of a taunting challenge in the original term. So it's a book of parables, of pictures. It isn't necessarily a book of literal, directly expressed ethical standards, though there are many ethical standards and values in it. In the first part of the book, the parables are quite long. And then suddenly the book changes gear, and from chapter 10, the parables are very short and pithy, verse by verse. It's remarkable in the Book of Proverbs. The pictures, the illustrations are so numerous. You couldn't think of as many. There are just so many illustrations to be employed in the Book of Proverbs. There is little advice, contrary to common expectations, there's little advice on non-spiritual aspects of life. If there is, it's actually incidental. It's actually to illustrate something spiritual. It is not a book, as printed in the top of the Bible so often, of sundry moral maxims. That's exactly the wrong way to view the Book of Proverbs. Everything has spiritual significance, as we're taught by the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 15 and verse 4. Everything will have significance to the Christian life and to the Christian church. So that's the first thing to always bear in mind. This is a book of parables. That's the title. And then secondly, the book has a triple aim, and that's announced down there in verse 4 of chapter 1. Certainly, in verses 2 and 3, there are other points raised, but they're general. But now the detail in verse 4 of chapter 1. The first aim of the book is evangelistic, to give subtlety to the simple. That's evangelism. The simple are the spiritually uninitiated, as we'll soon see. And to give them subtlety, cunning, literally, understanding, an ability to see and to grasp spiritual things. So it will be an evangelistic book. And secondly, it will be very much for young believers. The second point in verse 4, to the young man, the graduate, as it were, the convert, to the young man, knowledge and discretion. We'll look at that a little more. And thirdly, it's for mature believers. So spiritual naivety is the first point in verse 4. The uninitiated, the simple, and the first 9 chapters are pretty well for them, for the spiritually uninitiated. Secondly, discretion to the young man, cunning in a good sense. And then thirdly, in verses 5 and 6, harder things to the mature, and particularly to the teacher. A wise man will hear and will increase learning. And a man of understanding shall attain unto wise counsels, to understand a proverb and the interpretation, the words of the wise and their dark sayings. So you've moved from the unconverted to the young convert to the mature believer, including even the teacher and interpreter of the word. And that's the triple aim of the book of Proverbs, to educate all 3 categories. And then thirdly, I believe very much in the view that from chapter 10, the Proverbs are arranged under subjects. But you've got to figure out for yourself what the general themes or the subjects are. For example, if you look briefly, though we're coming back to the early chapters, if you look briefly at chapter 10 to establish this third point, that the bulk of the Proverbs are arranged under subjects, you'll find 2 lifestyles in verses 1 to 9. And the majority of the verses cover those 2 lifestyles. I'm going to look particularly at verse 10 of chapter 10, because it's very easy to establish that the main theme from verses 10 to 21 is clearly speech, words. And most of the verses, most of the Proverbs, are about speech, with the exception of only 2 verses, verses 15 and 16, where speech is not directly mentioned. Speech is the dominating theme of that block of verses. Verse 10, prating. Verse 11, mouth. Verse 12, verbal strife. Verse 13, lips. Verse 18 or 17, instruction. I missed 14, mouth again. Lying lips, verse 18. Verse 19, words. Verse 20, tongue. And verse 21, lips again. So all but 2 verses have to do with words and speech. And therefore the 2 verses that are the exception, verses 15 and 16, must be interpreted to take on the theme. And if you look at them, for example, verse 15, obviously, is an illustration of verse 14. Wise men lay up knowledge, but the mouth of the foolish is near destruction. The rich man's wealth, hold on to the theme of words in verse 14. His wealth in his words is his strong city. His strong city is his speech and the value of his words. And so there are 2 verses, 15 and 16, which become about speech. And you can analyze every chapter from chapter 10 and look at the verses carefully, and you will see that relatively easily each block of verses 15 to 20 verses, the majority of Proverbs will have the same theme. And those that do not, obviously fit, must be interpreted to fit the theme. Now, this view of the book of Proverbs from chapter 10, the shorter parables, this view accounts for one of the great problems of the book of Proverbs, that it has, to some degree, a feeling of being a disorganized ragbag, because quite a few proverbs are repeated in the book, and some a number of times, and it makes the book feel haphazard. Oh, here is this proverb again, and again, and again. Why does the writer seem to forget that he's employed that before? And so, unfortunately, the repetitions give the book a haphazard feel. But once you understand that from chapter 10, the book falls into themes, then you understand the repeated proverbs. They have a special significance, these repeated proverbs, when they are treated in the theme block in which they occur. Then it's obvious. Oh yes, I see it. That repeated proverb takes on the tone, the colour, the subject matter of the theme that it sits in. And oh yes, how well it works in that theme and serves that theme very specifically. And you realise it isn't a haphazard book at all. That proverb now takes on a distinctive meaning in that topic or theme of the block of proverbs it appears in. So it's valuable to see the themes of Proverbs. Sometimes you will wrestle with them. You will say, well, here is the wise and the foolish, and two or three blocks cover that theme. And sometimes you'll change your mind, and you'll see actually the majority of Proverbs have another topic in them, and that's the topic for that block of Proverbs. Fourthly, passing from that fascinating heading, well, I think it's fascinating anyway. Fourthly, the cast is very important. The cast in Proverbs. You are introduced to the cast in the opening chapters. The cast is occasionally, if somewhat obliquely, referred to in all the chapters after chapter 10 also. If you're watching for the cast to appear, you'll see them. You'll see the characters reflected, not necessarily specifically mentioned, but implicitly referred to in those proverbs. And the value of this is simply this, that the opening chapters of Proverbs have valuable reasoning on their own account, but they also give you the context for the rest of the book. And you've got a farm, and you've got the son working on the farm. I'll introduce you to the cast properly. And you've got his tender bride, and you've got the district gang in the background trying to entice the son away from work on the farm. And then you've got the adulteress. You've got a cast. And if you see in your mind the farm and the business of the farm and these different characters, it helps you to understand the rest of the book, because that is the context of the parables or the pictures that follow throughout the book. And they add meaning and colour to the Proverbs as you read them. So don't bring a great chopper down between chapters 9 and 10. Lose the cast and the context and think now everything is just sundry, unconnected moral maxims. You'll lose precious pictures and insight if you do that. So now, having said that, I'd like to introduce you to the cast. That's a bit condescending, I don't mean it. Many of you are already familiar with the cast, I'm sure. But first of all, the small holding, the context and the son are important. First member of the cast, verse 8, my son, hear the instruction of thy father, and forsake not the law of thy mother. He's going to appear repeatedly, the Son, throughout the book. The Father has a small holding and a trade. That was the way with Jewish people. You had your piece of land, and then you had a trade also, very often, to follow and to support you. The Son must learn everything from the Father. He's going to be married, and he's going to take over, inherit the small holding, and he's going to have to provide for his wife and his family. Or else he'll go into slavery, perhaps, into the employment of another. So I don't have to spend much time with the Son, although he's mentioned more than anyone throughout the book. I'd like to introduce you to the district gang. And there in verse 10, "My son, if sinners entice thee, consent thou not." And the district gang is described in the next 9 verses. Here they are in verse 10 and in verse 11. "If they say, come with us, let us lay wait for blood. Let us lurk privily for the innocent without cause." They want to give up work on the farm, and they want an alternative way of life. They're going to ambush caravans on the road, those passing by, vulnerable traders, and so on. They're going to set out of the village or the town to remote places and ambush them among the dunes. Verse 12, "Let us swallow them up alive as the grave, and whole as those that go down into the pit." We'll swoop on them, we'll kill them, we'll take the substance, and we'll bury them in the sands somewhere. That's the idea, and no one will ever know what we've done. There'll be dazzling rewards. Verse 13, "We shall find all precious substance, fill our houses with spoil." Naturally, there'll be suspicion about where this comes from. They may make the victims disappear, but obviously they're enriching themselves by crime. But it'll all happen so quickly. Verse 14, "Cast thy lot among us." This is a parable. It's an extended parable of the rape of young hearts by the world around, by Satan and his agents. They're depicted here in the district gang. "Bury the people out of sight." Verse 14, "With us you'll get comradeship. You're wanted. You matter. You'll feel good." It's a pretty obvious trap, actually. Verse 17, "Surely in vain the net is spread in the sight of any bird." This is such an obvious trap, and yet so many fall for it, because they get happiness and pleasure and possessions and sexual license from anything rather than worship or the service of the Lord. Well, you'll see them again in chapter 2 and verse 12, but it's the vicious district gang. And they crop up throughout the book in various ways. Then the third member of the cast is the tender bride. Verse 20, "Wisdom crieth without." Of course, the tender bride is amplified into the allegory of wisdom, which points to Christ, and of course gospel wisdom. But she's primarily introduced as the tender bride of the young man. "Wisdom crieth without, she uttereth her voice in the streets. When he's prone to go astray, she cries after him." She's more fully described, I suppose, in chapter 4 and verse 6. "Forsake her not, and she shall preserve thee. Love her, and she shall keep thee." And in verse 8, "Exalt her, and she shall promote thee. She shall bring thee to honour when thou dost embrace her." And verse 9, "She shall give to thine head an ornament of grace. A crown of glory shall she deliver to thee." She's wisdom, but she's also, by allegory, the tender bride. And she's going to be the one who's most hurt by his unfaithfulness to all the instruction that he's had. When he's cast out of his farmstead, she is the one with her family who will be most betrayed and will suffer. So there is the tender bride. And then there's the adulteress. and she features largely from chapter 5 and verse 3. For the lips of a strange woman drop as an honeycomb, and her mouth is smooth than oil, but her end is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death, her steps take hold on hell. He will lose all to the adulteress. Verse 9, lest thou give thine honour unto others and thy years unto the cruel. He's lost his land, his money, his tender bride. Lest strangers be filled with thy wealth and thy labours be in the house of a stranger. He's a servant or a slave, and thou mourn at the last, and you'll serve in a hard way until your death. And you'll lose special things that you used to have. So the appeal comes to the young man to avoid the adulteress, verse 15, so that he may drink waters out of thine own cistern, not use the common system of polluted waters of the village or the town, and running waters out of thine own well. Don't give up the things that you've learned, but rather be one who is a blessing to others. Stay with your instruction. Stay with the Lord. Verse 16, let thy fountains be dispersed abroad, and rivers of waters in the streets. So verse 1 and 2 of chapter 6 are the unfolding plot. My son, if thou be surety for thy friend, the adulteress, if thou hast stricken thy hand with a stranger, decided to honour and pay her debts, be her surety. Thou art snared with the words of thy mouth. Thou art taken with the words of thy mouth. Do this now, my son. Get out of it. End it. Terminate it while there's time. So that's the fourth member of the cast, the adulteress. And the fifth member of the cast is the dishonest district salesman. And you read about him in chapter 6 from verse 12. A naughty person, a wicked man, walketh with a froward mouth. He's worthless, he's wicked, he's flamboyant, he's demonstrative, he's fast talking. I'm sorry, Dr. Nettles. The connection should never have entered my mind. We leave you here in verse 13. He winketh with his eyes, he speaketh with his feet, he teacheth with his fingers. Actually, very interesting description of a dishonest salesman, the more you think about it. He's persuasive. He gives all the virtues and the promises of the world. Well, he's the dishonest district salesman. He goes around the towns and the villages selling second-hand farm equipment that doesn't work and all that kind of thing. He's described quite elaborately in the passage. So that's the cast. Oh, it'd take me a long time to go into it further, but they're always in the background in the subsequent Proverbs, adding colour, adding context, though each one of them will give you tremendous evangelistic preaching opportunities if you treat them as parables. Let's look for an example, because time is rushing on, at chapter 7. Here in chapter 7 is the approach to the young man of the adulteress. Well, I suppose it would be legitimate to make use of chapter 7 to warn people against adultery. But that's not the point of the chapter. Everything here has a spiritual objective. This is about spiritual adultery. Actually, it's about something more basic than that. As I mentioned before, the rape of the mind and the heart by the world, the spiritual seduction of the young and the naive by the world around. This is a parable. It's an illustration. The adulteress stands for all the forces and arguments and alluring ideas of Satan. It's spiritual seduction that it's pointed to, and that's how you must use it. And if you open a commentary And you see, it never rises above the basic meaning of the parable, literal seduction. It's a bad commentary. It hasn't understood how to use the book of Proverbs. It's much richer than simply a narrative of seduction. In fact, it's got amazing things. One of the greatest literary devices ever is in this book, even from a human standpoint. Look at verse 6. For at the window of my house I looked through my casement. It's the most amazing window in the Bible. It's the most amazing window in all literature. That window can see in pitch dark. It can see round corners. Looking out of that window, the narrative sees the entire scene. The seducer approaching from another street. Time passes from day to night, and yet everything is seen fully out of this remarkable window. There's some extraordinary literary devices in the book of Proverbs. Anyway, you look at the beginning of chapter 7, all the sympathy of the book there. My son, the boy is in mind, the young man, keep my words and lay up my commandments with thee. The warnings, bind them, verse 3, upon thy fingers, write them upon the table of thine heart. Incidentally, isn't it significant that the actual spiritual purpose of these parables is neglected today? Spiritual adultery is never touched upon in the churches today, or not very much. So you've got the great slide into the uniting of the world with the church. You've got the great celebrity preachers with all their worldliness, employing and deploying worldly culture in worship and in their methodology entirely. Nobody's thinking these days in terms of spiritual adultery. And when those great reform preaching celebrities come to expound Proverbs chapter 7, they keep below the spiritual sense because it would condemn them. It's only about the basic earthly side of the parable. No wonder it's so easy to commit spiritual adultery these days, because the spiritual view of these things is so seldom taken. I'm sorry for the negative observation. Verse 7, out of the window, the narrator sees among the simple ones, the unconverted, the spiritually naive, uninitiated, I discerned among the youths a young man void of understanding. But he is the son who's already been introduced. Passing through the street near her corner, and he went the way to her house. In the twilight, the daylight's gone already, in the evening, in the black and dark night, telling you that the narrative is going to pass over several hours, from twilight to pitch darkness. And behold, there met him a woman with the attire of an harlot, and subtle of heart. Well, I must hurry. She's obvious to those who know, but her trade and her intentions are not obvious to the spiritually naive. What a theme, dear friend, to gently preach on. Before we're converted, we think we're so knowing, so wise. Some people would think themselves streetwise to the tone of this parable. And our business as preachers is to show people gently and inoffensively how little they know about the real meaning of life and the spiritual dimension and the things of God. Here there's somebody who doesn't know. There are Christians who don't know about the spiritual warfare and the spiritual battle and the great seducer who follows them on every street corner and tracks their moments and their lives, who has to be opposed and prepared for. This woman in verse 11, she's loud and stubborn. Loud really suggests humor. She jokes. jokes and laughs. Her feet abide not in her house. Verse 12, she stalks him. Now she is without, now in the streets, and lieth in wait at every corner. And she catches him and flatters him. Verse 13, kissed him, and with an impudent face said unto him, I have peace offerings with me. She even feigns godliness and religion, because that's how this naive young man has been brought up. So the great seducer knows how to come clad in religious clothes. This day have I paid my vows. She feigns godliness. And today, rock comes into the church and rap, sanitized with kind of Christian lyrics. And the naive are taken in. Verse 15, therefore came I forth to meet thee, diligently to seek thy face. I want to know you. You matter to me. He must feel wanted again. And then verse 16, look what's thrown into this enticing approach. Art and interests and luxuries and perfumes. I have decked my bed with coverings of tapestry. Well, you can read it for yourself. With carved objects of art, with fine linen of Egypt. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill of love. The world appeals with love and gratification and satisfaction. There's no danger. Verse 19, for the good man is not at home. He's gone on a long journey. He's taken a bag of money. He will come home at the day appointed, and with her much fair speech. You've got to apply this and see the spiritual application and sense. First of all, to the unconverted, in engaging terms and convicting terms, and then even to the Lord's people, to show the course of spiritual adultery. Then there's the sudden act. He falls, verse 22, he goeth after straightway, as an ox goeth to the slaughter. The ox rushes of his own accord, finally. And the narrative proceeds and goes on. He betrays the bride. There's a great fall. Verse 23, a dart strikes through his liver. He goes as a bird, hasteth to the snare, and knoweth not that it is for his life. And the application for the soul comes in verse 27. Her house is the way to hell. Ah, the parable ends with the narrator making it, Solomon, making it abundantly clear that this is a parable about hell, not just about adultery. Going down to the chambers of death, it's about the course of life and its destination. And that's how we should preach it. And chapter 8, the dramatic change of tone, the appeal to the soul, the great tender of salvation. Doth not wisdom cry, and understanding put forth her voice? Verse 5, O ye simple, understand wisdom, and ye fools, be ye of an understanding heart. Didn't we understand that chapter 7 was about the soul, and about spiritual walk, and about the seduction of the world? And verse 11, for wisdom is better than rubies, and all the things that may be desired are not to be compared to it. It's about the gospel and light and redemption and purchase and adoption and communion with Christ and power and the faculty of prayer and knowing the deep things of God and about heaven. These are tremendous things, these chapters. Oh, friends, I go back to conclude to chapter 2 and verses 1 to 5. This is a spiritual book. Long parables, short parables, all about the Christian life and indeed the Christian church. My son, if thou wilt receive my words and hide my commandments with thee, so that thou incline thy ear unto wisdom and apply thine heart to understanding, yea, if thou criest after knowledge, and liftest up thy voice for understanding, if thou seekest her as silver, and searchest for her as for hid treasures, then shalt thou understand the fear of the Lord, and find the knowledge of God. For the Lord giveth wisdom. Out of his mouth cometh knowledge and understanding. Surely that's the key to the whole book. How can I say that those sundry moral maxims, those ethical directions from chapter 10 to the end, how can I say that they are spiritual? And the simple answer is, dear friends, well, because this is the Bible. That's its topic, its subject, its theme, from end to end. There's no simpler, there's no better answer. And with that, I close.